And we're doing chapter 23 of the commentary and chapter 10 of the Gita. Or we're doing all of the book commentary. I don't think we're doing all of the verse. Swamiji explains that this verse has a lot of lists in it. And these lists are lists of the various attributes. Well, you'll see what they are. But they're lists of all the ways in which God manifests. And it's, we're just wanting to see. Yeah, it's the whole chapter 10. So it's chapter 10 of the Gita and 23 of the book. So God explains that he is quite a few things in this chapter, so we'll just enjoy it. So I'm not going to read each verse because they sort of run into each other. So it's all of chapter 10 I'm reading. The blessed Lord said, O mighty armed Arjuna, hear now my supreme utterance. Speaking for your highest good, I will say more to you who have listened with joy. Neither the multitude of gods, angels, nor the great sages in their human state know me in my unmanifested state. I am their source and origin. Whoever realizes me, however, unborn and without any beginning, as well as even now the Lord of creation, has conquered delusion and is sinless, though he inhabit a human body. Discrimination, wisdom, calm clarity, forgiveness, truthfulness, sense control, inner peace, joy, sorrow, birth, death, fear, courage, harmlessness, equanimity, serenity, self-discipline, charity, fame, notoriety. These states, vastly diverse as they are, derive from my one self. They are modifications of my one essential nature. The seven great rishis, the primeval four, and the 14 manus are all modifications of my nature, born of my projected thought and endowed with creative powers like mine. From these progenitors come all the life forms on earth. He who realizes the truth of my prolific manifestations and the creative and dissolving power of my divine yoga is unshakably united to me. I am the source of everything. From me, all creation emerges. Realizing this great truth, the wise, awe-stricken, adore me. Their thoughts engrossed in me, their being surrendered to me, enlightening one another and conversing of me, they are ever contented and filled with joy. To those who are attached only to me and who worship me with love, I impart that discernment of wisdom by which they attain me completely, out of pure compassion, that is, out of the selfless gift of love, with no admixture of compulsion. I, the Divine One, who dwells in all, set alight in their hearts the blazing lamp of wisdom, which banishes their darkness of ignorance. Arjuna said in adoration, O Lord, Thou art the Supreme Spirit, the Supreme Shelter, the Supreme Purity, the One Self-Manifested Being, the Causeless, the Eternal, the Omnipresent. Thus do all the sages, the Divine Seer, Narada, Asila, Devala, Vyasa, and you yourself, Krishna, declare. Arjuna continues, O Keshava, Krishna, I consider all that you have revealed to me as the eternal truth. Neither gods nor demons can know your multifarious manifestations. O Supreme Person, Arjuna continues, origin of beings, Lord of all creatures, God of gods, sustainer of the world, verily you alone are self-knowing. Please expound fully to me your perfect powers by which, being omnipresent, you sustain the universe. O Supreme Yogi Krishna, how shall I meditate on you to know you as you are? In what forms and aspects can I most accurately think of you? O Krishna, tell me at length of your yoga powers and manifestations, for I never tire of listening to this nectar-like speech of yours. The blessed Lord said, O best of princes, Arjuna, I shall willingly relate to you something of my manifestations, but I'll relate only those which are outstanding, for of my variety there is no end. O Gudakesha, conqueror of sleep, Arjuna, I am the true self, dwelling in the heart of all creatures. I am the beginning, the continuation, and end of their existence. Among the Aditas, the Vedic gods, I am Vishnu. Among luminaries in the sky, I am the sun. Among the wind gods, I am Marichi, the most beneficial wind. Among nocturnal luminaries, I am the moon. Among the Vedas, I am the Samaveda, on account of its musical beauty. Among the gods, I am Indra. Of sense perceptions, I am mind, the perceiver. In creatures, I am their intelligence. Among the Rudras, the intelligent life forces, I am Shankara, their empowering intelligence. Among Yakshas and Rakshasas, astral abstractions of human desire, I am Kubera, the god of wealth. Among Vasus, the vitalizing force, I am Pravaka, Agni, the god of fire. Among mountain peaks, I am Meru. Of priests, O son of Pritha, Arjuna, know me to be Brihaspati, guru of the gods. Among generals, I am Skanda, Kartikeya, the god of war. Among bodies of water, I am the ocean. Among great rishis, I am Bhrigu. Among words, I am the syllable Om. Among yagyas, sacred rituals, I am Japa Yagya, silent, superconscious chanting. Among things unmoving, I am the Himalayas. Among trees, I am Ashvata. Among the divine seers, I am Narada. Among the Gandharvas, the gods of music, I am Chitrarata. Among perfected beings, I am Kapila, the exponent of Shankhya. Among horses, I am the nectar-born Ukasravas. Among elephants, I am Indra's elephant, Aravata. Among men, I am a monarch. Among weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among cows, I am Kamaduk, the fulfiller of desires. In sexual desire, I am procreation. Among serpents, I am Vasiki. Among the Naga serpents, I am Ananta, endless. Among water beings, I am Varuna. Among departed ancestors, I am Aryama. Among those who maintain law and order, I am Yama. Among the Datyas, I am Prahlad. Among measurers, I am time. Among animals, I am their king, the lion. Among birds, I am Garuda, lord of the skies. In classical symbology, the vehicle of Vishnu. Among purifiers, I am the wind. Among wielders of weapons, I am Rama. Among aquatic creatures, I am Makara, the vehicle of the ocean god. Among rivers, I am the Ganges, the holiest. Among all manifestations, O Arjuna, I am their beginning, middle, and end. Among the various branches of knowledge, I am the wisdom of the self. Among debates, I am the clearest reasoning. Among all letters, I am the first in the alphabet. Among compounds, I am the connector. In time, I am the immutable. In creation, I am the omnipresent, and ever turn my face in all directions. I am all dissolving death. I am birth. I am the origin of things yet to be. Among feminine manifestations, the qualities of Prakriti, or Mother Nature, I am fame, success, the illuminating power of speech, memory, intuitive discrimination, firmness and loyalty, and patience. Among hymns, I am Brihat Saman. Among poetic meters, I am Gayatri. Among months, I am Marga Hirsha, the auspicious winter months. Among seasons, I am Kasumakara, the flower bringer, spring. Among deceivers, I am gambling. Of the glorious, I am glory. For those who strive to win, I am victory. Among the good, I am Satwa, the elevating quality. Among Vrishnis, I am Vasudeva, Krishna. Among the Pandavas, I am yourself, Dhananjaya, Arjuna. Among the Munis, the saints, I am Vyasa. Among sages, I am Ushanas. I am the rod of discipline. I am the skill of the victorious. I am the silence of hidden things. Among knowers, I am wisdom. Whatsoever constitutes the reproductive seed of all beings, that I am. There is nothing, O Arjuna, moving or unmoving, that exists apart from me. O scorcher of foes, Arjuna, the manifestations of my divine attributes are without limit. This brief declaration of them merely hints at them. Whatever being is endowed with power, prosperity, or glory, know that endowment itself to be only a spark of my effulgence. What need have you, however, O Arjuna, for these manifold details? Know this only, I, the unchanging and everlasting, permeate and sustain the entire cosmos with but a fragment of my essential being. Thus ends the 10th chapter called From the Unmanifested to the Manifested of the Upanishad of the Holy Bhagavad Gita in the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna discussing yoga and the science of God realization. Well, that is a fun chapter, isn't it? There was a beautiful baby at Ananda Sisi, just an exceptionally beautiful baby. Her name was Sabina. And Devi christened her, among babies, I am Sabina. This is a way of really praising someone when you want to. You know, the Swami makes reference in the commentary that some of these references are a little obscure to Westerners. Some of them are obscure even to modern Indians, because Krishna was making references to things that were known at the time. Because every master, even though what he speaks is timeless, he speaks it to whoever he's talking to. That's why Jesus used lots of images of sheep and shepherds and farming and harvests, because the people he was talking to, that's what they knew about. Yogananda talked about airplanes and telephones and television and films, which are not images Jesus could have used very effectively. And if he talked to us about sheep and sheep herding and harvesting the wheat, we wouldn't exactly resonate immediately with what he was talking about. So what Krishna is making a huge list of here, and many of the names that we don't know are what the people of his time and Arjuna and the others all revered as the most glorious manifestations, except for the one he throws in where he says, among deceit, I am gambling. You know, almost everything that he lists is something of a glorious nature, but he throws that one in, Swamiji tells us, just to sort of tell you that he's the energy in everything that happens. And even, you know, some kind of negative things are still really well done. I remember years ago, Swami went to see some movie. I no longer remember what it was, but it was a sort of a thriller. And afterwards, Swami remarked that it was extremely well done. Someone said, oh, should we go see it? He said, I didn't say it was worth seeing. I just said it was well done. You know, there's a very interesting point in all of this that I want to start with here. Does anyone have any questions from reading this before I start? Okay, he has a commentary here that is, and I'll just read this paragraph. The essential significance Krishna gives them, all these lists of things, is that whatever is brightest, best, strongest, most glorious, or most intelligent is the clearest manifestation of God. I loved he had in there, in the debate, I am the clearest reasoning. Okay. Not so much in the sense that the highest wave is more his manifestation than the lowest, but in the sense rather that when tamas and restless rajas least obscure a divine quality, the result is like a thinning cloud cover which veils the moon and renders it more visible. Okay, there's been an issue that sort of lurks behind a whole lot of spiritual questions, and I've never actually in all these years found exactly the way to answer it, even though common sense always gave me an answer. And that is why, if this world is only a dream and the only thing that matters is we realize God, why is it still important to work for excellence in everything that you do? And there's a tremendous misunderstanding on the spiritual path that some people abuse really terribly. When I was 18 years old is when I was first introduced to the spiritual path, and I was introduced by my peers, and we really didn't have any real teachers. I did eventually get over to the Ramakrishna Society and would attend lectures by the Swami there, but he was an Indian Swami, and he seemed distant still. I mean, I was too young to really relate to him, and he just seemed distant, and he wasn't really my real teacher, so I kept the distance. When I met Swami finally I felt like I had somebody to guide me. But what I was saying is for those first 4 or 5 years, even though we got input from books, it was just me and my friends trying to figure it out. And they came up, some of them came up with really preposterous theories. And a lot of these preposterous theories were all based on, well, if the world is only a dream and it's only an illusion, then what difference does it make what you do? And one man actually became a thief on that rationalization. You know, if all, everything is the same and it all belongs to everyone, then what difference does it make if I take it from you? I sort of, even though I couldn't argue the point, I was endowed with enough innate common sense to realize that there was something very fundamentally wrong with what they were saying. But I really appreciate here what he's saying. And what he's talking about is he's talking about the gunas. And the gunas we've talked about in a number of other places, but just to, you know, bring it to clear focus here. Krishna explains that all of creation is the interplay of these three dimensions. And these dimensions are tamas, which is called the darkening quality, which just sort of pulls everything into a obscurity from the light. And you can be very tamasic by being very egoic, and that tamasic quality within you blinds you to the spirit everywhere. The rajasic energy is active energy. And America and this whole planet at this time is a very, very rajasic planet. And America as a country is a very, very rajasic country. People in this country just move and do things all the time. Many other cultures, Asian cultures, Oriental cultures, India, China, not China modern day, but traditionally, they just move a lot slower. Indian ashrams, even today, people don't really do a lot. You just kind of go to the ashram and you meditate a little and you hang out and you go to the ceremony. And Swami Kriyananda said he used to visit Anandamoyi Ma's ashram and he loved being there with Anandamoyi Ma, but he could never imagine living in the ashram because they just sort of never really did anything. They were just sort of there. Whereas the American concept, and it is also the concept Vivekananda tried to instill in the Ramakrishna order, was one of active service. And Swami was also saying that Americans just can't do nothing. We just get bored and restless almost immediately because we're a very, very rajasic country. Now, this is good if that rajasic energy is neutral in itself. It depends on whether it's merely running in circles or whether it's constructive, focused, positive activity. There's a story that Swamiji tells in his book, The Path, which is about his years with Master. And he talks about a nun who was a disciple of Master there. And she tended to be rajasic by nature. She was too restless. And Master was cooking in the kitchen, and she was sitting in the kitchen with him while he cooked. And she thought, well, instead of just sitting here, maybe I can just help clean up. So he would cook, and he was working, and he would dirty a bowl or something, and then she'd wash it. And without Master's demeanor never changed, his attitude never changed, but she kept noticing that he was the sloppiest cooking she'd ever seen. The more dishes she washed, the more he was dirtying dishes, and he was just making such a mess that no matter how fast and how much she worked, she just couldn't keep up with him. And finally it just occurred to her, well, maybe instead of trying to do this, I'll just wait till he's finished. And then she just sat down, and then she observed that all of a sudden, you know, the whole flow of dirty dishes just slowed down completely. And during all of this, Master never said anything or never seemed to be any different in what he was doing. But he realized he was teaching her a lesson. It's not necessary at all times to be constantly restlessly moving. You know, productive activity is one thing, but restless rajas merely for its own sake, which is what our culture is about. Now, we're essentially kept in a frenzy by the culture. You're never given a moment of peace. And much of the energy that's directed toward us is also tamasic, it's blinding. The tradition of tamasic is that it's just low energy and dull. Now, the third quality is sattvic energy. And sattvic energy is the calming, peaceful, spiritually uplifting vibrations that are part of this world. So what we see in this world is we see dull, darkening energy that's just going into inactivity and unconsciousness. We see activating energy that's rising, trying to make everything just restless and excited all the time. And then the sattvic energy is trying to pull them both into a state of equanimity. And so we'll often use those words. These are good vocabulary words to know because there really aren't equivalent English words. And oftentimes somebody say, well, you know, how was the restaurant? Well, the food was good, but it was very rajasic, someone will say, which just meant that it was just active and noisy for no particular purpose. Or how was the restaurant? Oh, it's very tamasic in there, meaning it, maybe it wasn't clean, maybe the waiters were only half awake, you know, but the energy was very darkening and you didn't feel like it. Or I was talking about at Spiritual Renew Week, I was very, very active. I hope I was sattvically rajasic, but I was very active. Last week I felt very tamasic. I just felt very dull. It is sort of the balancing energy between. Now, the point of spiritual life is obviously to overcome tamasic energy through the intelligent application of rajasic energy, but the rajasic energy needs to gradually, even if you're very active, that you become what Master calls actively calm. That even in the midst, even of intense energy, that the energy remains sattvic. Because sattvic isn't inactivity. Tamasic is inactivity. Sattvic isn't inactive. It's merely calmly active, God-centered, peace-producing. A master like Paramahansa Yogananda, extremely dynamic in his activity, but he was never anything but sattvic. Swami writes here, it was very touching where he says, it would be very helpful for people to realize that even Jivan Muktas, even fully liberated masters, accept in their human state some human limitations. Excuse me, and they feel normal emotions. But he says here, Swami writes, I used often to observe when my guru expressed perfectly natural human feelings that he always did so in a sattvic manner. His eyes were fathomlessly calm. It was obvious that he was inwardly untouched. Isn't that interesting? Swami Kriyananda has often mentioned that sometimes people really don't understand him, speaking of himself, because even when he has very strong feelings about things, he never moves away from being very centered. And so it's hard for people to understand sometimes if they aren't sensitive or don't know him, that he's really expressing a very strong opinion or a very strong attitude or a very strong response. But because he always does it in a sattvic manner, most of us are used to energy. I knew an unfortunate marriage that didn't last. He was of a fiery temperament, and she was extremely, she was British and he was not. And her point of view was always, you know, when she expressed even very great upset, she would say something such as, I'm really displeased with what you have done. And his point of view was that if dishes weren't being smashed against the wall, nobody was having an emotion at all. You know, it's just like a whole different way of looking at these things now. There's cultural differences like that, but even that restrained expression is not necessarily sattvic, because the energy, it could be, in fact, more tamasic than sattvic. It can be an inability to express oneself, a fear of expressing oneself. You know, it can be. I'm not saying that it is. But it can be, you know. You can't really tell just by looking. It has to do with really what the inner consciousness is. When Jesus picked up the whip and drove the money changers out of the temple, he was certainly using the activating quality to do that. There was nothing tamasic about it. And it was very forceful. But I suspect, just like this, that if you were able to look into his eyes, you would see that he was, as Swami puts it so perfectly, he was inwardly untouched by it. It was just necessarily what had to happen. Now, the process of liberating ourselves from this ever-oscillating world of human consciousness where the waves rise and fall and rise and fall is we have to work through various things. First of all, we have to overcome within us the tamasic tendency, because the tamasic tendency is that whole aspect of our nature which tells us that the less awareness we have, the happier we'll be and the better off we are. And it's a very enticing concept. It says, oh, well, you know, you really shouldn't go to class tonight because after all, you're tired, just go to bed. I don't mean just common sense. I mean when it just sort of says to you, oh, I can't really meditate tonight, I'll meditate tomorrow. Or let me just, you know, eat this pint of ice cream or drink this couple of beers. After all, I need to relax, you know. So you come home and you're tense from an experience that happens, and we look for ways of calming our consciousness by becoming lower in our energy or our consciousness. We flip on the television. We, eat the ice cream. We drink wine or drink beer if that's our habit, or we take even stronger drugs than that. That somehow, whatever anxiety or discomfort I'm feeling, if I can just become unconscious, then that will help solve the problem. And that unconsciousness can manifest itself as, you know, I have some very serious problem in front of me, I'm just going to pretend I don't. You know, I'm living with someone whose energy is very incompatible. Maybe this person is actually an alcoholic and all the signs are there, but I'm not going to pay attention to it. I'm going to just pretend it's not happening. Anything that tells us that if we can just dull our awareness, that's what tamasic energy is. And you can just see that the opposite of that, sattvic energy, is spiritual energy, is fully aware. The whole process of spiritual growth is literally an expansion of awareness. Because if you think about it, the state of divine unity that someday we will consciously know is as much with us in this moment as it ever has been and ever will be. It's such a remarkable thing to think about. Swamiji often says, we are as old, you are as old as God himself, because we are part of the infinite creation. We are ageless. The bodies come and go, but that which is our true nature, but we're not aware of it, are we? We are so used to identifying with this limited reality that we just go instinctively day after day, making all our decisions and our responses as if this was the reality, until our awareness gradually expands. And of course, that's what all of us are in the process of doing right now, aren't we? We're expanding our awareness. We're learning about what the Bhagavad Gita has to say. We're trying to get more in tune with Krishna. We're learning Kriya Yoga. We're learning all the many, many things that you're learning here or wherever you're expanding your awareness. We're trying to become moving away from tamasic unconsciousness into greater and greater states of awareness. And part of the problem is that we, you know, so we're sort of reluctant to know things sometimes. And it's hard even, we have to prepare ourselves for this greater and greater knowledge. I remember once at Ananda Village, I had to work all night on a project. And I worked all night and then I stayed up all the next day. And by the time bedtime came, as it happened, I was completely wide awake. Whatever sleepiness I had felt was all gone at that point. And I could have just gone on working. Whether I could or not, I didn't. Because whether I was sleepy or not, I was tired of being awake. I just longed for the pleasure of just being unconscious for a while. And it occurred to me how much of fatigue and sleep and so on is just that. It's just tiresome to always have to be aware. And the masters have exactly the opposite experience. Yogananda said once to his devotees, he said, last night when I went to sleep, I experimented with going into subconsciousness. Because when he would sleep, he would go into a superconscious state. He said, I experimented with going into subconsciousness. It was terrible, he said, hemmed in on all sides by thick walls of flesh. That's how he defined it. You know, whereas, to be perfectly honest, I crawl into my little bed, I put my head on my little pillow, I pull my covers up, and I welcome those comforting, sort of diminishing awareness. It's a very pleasurable feeling because tamasic energy is still quite attractive to me at times. Not overall, but at times within the realm of things. Okay? So what we're having to do in our lives, first of all and above all, is to banish our attachment or attraction to tamasic energy. Now, even at the highest state, you always have all three elements. As long as you're in creation, all three elements are in place. Even a master rests sometimes. Even a master sleeps sometimes. Although what state master would go into, I don't really know, given that comment about superconsciousness. But still, a master would have a time when he would eat or rest on his bed. You know, and even master, once he was having his picture taken, and someone wanted to take his picture, he said, just a moment, let me go into samadhi. Okay, you can take the picture now. So, I mean, like, what state was he in prior to that? Who knows? But there was still some little shift of his consciousness. And Ramakrishna, whose difficulty, as he was an avatar in the 1800s in Dakshineshwar outside of Calcutta, his problem was that his consciousness was always going beyond this world so much so that he couldn't relate. And he wanted to relate to the people and the devotees, and he would go into these states where he would lose awareness of all of that. And whenever he would begin to come down, he would always have to do something that would anchor his mind. He would ask for food or water, or he would smoke a water pipe, which you would think would be an odd thing for him to do, but he would smoke it because it would help keep his consciousness down. Master used to collect umbrellas and opals, and he'd go shopping for things, and that would be a way of keeping his mind more in this world. Trouble keeping his consciousness in this world as we do is getting our consciousness out of this world. In other words, that tamoguna has been conquered in their nature. Swami Kriyananda is like that, very much so. I made the remark the other day when I had to speak about him that in all the years I've known him, I can't think of a single day. Of course, I haven't always been with him every single day. But I don't think there's been a single day when he hasn't done some creative or serviceful work. And I mean like the morning after he has heart surgery, or when he has a high fever from pneumonia, or just at times when any normal person would feel justified in just sinking into tamasic energy. In fact, he had this preface that he had to edit when he had heart surgery, and he had a deadline he had to meet, and the first thing he was doing as he was coming out of the anesthetic was to edit that book. And he said later he feels like he recovered much faster, because instead of just drifting in tamasic energy like a normal person would do, he used his willpower to sort of raise his consciousness above it, and that brought much more energy into his system and really made him heal faster, because a master has complete command over rajasic energy, the complete ability to manifest whatever activating energy is required at any time. In fact, so important is that ability that that Yogananda's profound original contributions, one of his original contributions to the practice of yoga, is what we call the energization exercises. And most of you have learned those, although not all of you. You learn it in meditation too, if you haven't yet. And it's a series of it's about 12 minutes, 32 exercises, I believe. They take about 12 minutes to carry through. And they use the body to train the will to draw energy at will to be able to do whatever you need to do. You practice on the physical body having as much energy as your will requires, because we also have to master, just as we have to escape from tamasic energy, we have to master the use of rajasic energy. Because on this particular planet, work is done by the use of rajasic energy. You have to be active in order to make things happen. You need to be able to call on that energy at will. You know, and it really becomes part of your nature. I have nothing, even a fraction of the energy that Swamiji has. But because I've been energizing all these years and because I understand these principles, most of the time I can do whatever it is that I'm asked to do. I was just talking about last week at Spiritual Renewal Week, my friend was packing up her house and moving to Oregon, Durga and Vidura moving to Oregon, and she had this whole attic worth of stuff, and you know, her husband really didn't want to haul it up to Oregon, and she didn't quite know what to do, so I spent several very, very, very hot afternoons up in that attic just helping her. It's so much easier when someone sits next to you and helps you, just sorting through all this stuff and repacking it for her, and then after that, we started cooking for this big banquet, and so was doing this banquet, and it was very, very busy, but I never flagged. I just went through the whole thing and then drove home and gave service. And that's because of the energization exercises, really, above all things, because it's just taught us that if you need energy, you exercise willpower. And we've practiced every day, at least once a day, just doing that exercise of having mastery over the rajasic energy in a sattvic manner, because it's the use of inner willpower. Now, that's also important, obviously, because in order to overcome tamas, you have to have rajas to overcome it. You can't overcome tamas just by sort of wishing it away. And that's what, again, one of the ways that people twist the spiritual path is, well, because tamasic energy, which is sort of dull and inert, looks a great deal like sattvic energy, which may be completely motionless and lost in samadhi. So we think, okay, I'm not really tamasic, I'm actually spiritual. And so you'll see people who are really, what they really need is rajasic energy. Swami Vivekananda was very, very radical in his approach to India. He thought the Indians should become meat eaters, which I don't necessarily think was the right answer, but he was trying to move the country because he felt the country was so tamasic, they simply needed to become more rajasic. Even Yogananda in this country, for example, recommended the eating of certain rajasic foods like onions and garlic and eggs, which others would say is, oh, you shouldn't have those, you know, they're not sattvic enough. He said, well, in this country, you need rajasic energy. People have to work rajasically here, and so we need things that will stimulate them like that. These are the lives that we're living. He didn't go so far as to recommend a non-vegetarian diet, but he said in some cases, people need to eat a little bit of flesh because their bodies are just too accustomed to it. He wasn't strict about those things. And then obviously, where all of this is leading, we overcome tamasic energy with the right use of rajasic energy, but then we gradually make everything we do more and more sattvic. So even though, as is described here, we may have, you know, normal human emotions, and we may need to be involved in these things, inwardly we remain free. So whatever is asked of us, we can do with our full willpower. We don't have any desire to go unconscious and to shrink from it, but we do it with a deeper and deeper inward sense of God's presence. The difference being the image that has been earlier in this book, where Master once was asked, you know, what's the difference between a master and an ordinary person? And he talked about that the ego is like the waves on the ocean. Now, the normal thought you would have would be you would think of a master as being the biggest wave on the whole ocean. That's just the way the human mind would think. But he says it's actually the ego, the strong rajasic ego, that pushes its wave way up as far as it can to be separate from the ocean, whereas the master actually moves right on the surface of the ocean. He never separates himself from the ocean. He remains one with it. That's the strong, the sattvic energy is never to lose contact with it. Even if energy has to rise in a wave, there's always that awareness of the whole ocean underneath it, where the egoic wave, the purely rajasic wave, sort of fights and fights and fights to be this big separate thing. And then basically, you know, tamasic energy comes and it crashes. It's just this ever alternating force. Now, coming back to this whole verse that we're talking about, you know, getting those images clearly in mind, if we're going to overcome these qualities and balance them within us, we can't do it at this stage of our karma just by wishing to make it happen. We can't do it just by affirmation. We can't do it just by philosophy, just by thinking about it, because these are deep-seated karmic tendencies within us. We have these deep-seated vrittis within us that keep compelling our consciousness in certain directions, and we have to counter that energy. Who we are karmically, who we are right at this moment, is the accumulated result of all of absolutely everything, thought, feeling, action, desire, expressed or unexpressed, of all our past lives, create a karmic pattern in the chakras, and that karmic pattern is the magnetism of who we are. Everything about our physical body, our personality, our life, it's all dictated by that. When we shift that is when our whole consciousness becomes different. Now, that's something that we created ourselves, and therefore it is us that we're talking about. But it becomes, how do I want to say it? It becomes a force that's independent of our ability to change it just with a thought, because it's an accumulation of energy. That's the word I'm trying to use. If we've had a certain thought and attitude for a very long time, there's a certain magnetism that's built up just by sheer repetition. If you think of every time you think a hateful thought towards somebody who's been unkind to you, you just, each time you think that thought, it has a certain amount of energy, and that amount of energy affixes itself to the idea of ego, which is that this is how I feel about this situation as it affects me. And each time we think that thought, it becomes another unit of energy, so to speak, until the units become very, very strong. Now, when it first occurs to us that this is a bad idea, if the thought that it's a bad idea to think those hateful thoughts is worth a penny, and we've got $5,000 worth of pennies of this thought, and you weigh them in the balance, the penny of maybe I should be different just can't hold up against all the pennies we put in on the opposite side. If you think of your consciousness as a marble rolling on the marble floor, so to speak, the floor is tilted in whichever direction the biggest weight is. If you think of a balance scale, if we've been hateful for a long time, we may be trying to build up this side of the scale, but there's still a lot down here. So this is a very strong force field, and we have our consciousness. We're working hard to make it different, but it it tends to keep falling in there because the pit is really big. So we have to keep resisting, and we can switch a habit, a karma, an attitude. Even if you've had it for lifetimes, you can switch it like that. If you put the same amount of energy into the new commitment that you have already put into the old commitment. You see? And that doesn't mean that you can't make those changes, but that's why you can't just want to be different today and then be different tomorrow. Unless what has happened is a long, you know, deep process of slowly, slowly coming to this point of view. And then what happens? All that it has to shift is that much. You see, for everything in your world to change. As soon as it leans even a micron in the direction you're trying to go, then your consciousness rolls in that direction. I felt 12-year cycles in spiritual life are very significant astrologically, and a lot of times changes take place in 12s. After my first 12 years on the spiritual path, I really woke up in the morning and I felt completely different. It just happened so quickly. It happened like almost overnight. But what I felt was that all of those 12 years of effort, including all my failures, everything, but the perseverance of 12 years had just taken my mind, which had been tilted. I felt like, the way I said it to Swami, I felt like my subconscious had been working against me. And then all of a sudden, it started working for me. And I mean, that just made all the difference in the world. It wasn't like everything had gone away, but all of a sudden, the floor was tilted in the direction I was trying to go. And so the marble rolled a little bit easier. Instead of rolling down into the tamasic attitudes I didn't want to have, it started rolling toward the relatively speaking more enlightened attitudes that I was now having. Of course, then the whole thing has to keep going over and over again. Now, let me think where I wanted to go with that. I know what I was saying. But what this all lends itself to is that for our own spiritual well-being, you see, we have to be engaged, we have to be fully engaged at all times in a constant effort to shift this tamasic, rajasic, sattvic balance within us. And if we stop making that effort or say, oh, that's good enough, that very decision, you see, just sinks us back into a more tamasic reality. And as soon as we do that, we doom ourselves to a continuation of our entrapment. There was a time when Swami Kriyananda Swami Kriyananda's music was newer in the community of Ananda, and at first he wrote his songs just for solo voice, and then he wrote them for groups of people to sing. He wrote harmonies and small groups, quartets, and six singers, and so on. People would start singing the arrangements of his songs. And they were untrained singers for the most part. Most of the people who sing at Ananda, even the ones who sing beautifully, are just devotees who just learned to sing. And often these new groups would sing at Sunday services where Swami himself was present. He would be giving the service, and then the musicians would get up to sing. And very often, in the middle of a service, even the middle of the song, he would stop them and correct them. You know, that's not how the note goes. And then he would say the note or pronounce the word like this. And it was very interesting in the community because the singers themselves never minded. You know, they were happy to get his instruction for the most part. But often other people were just, how can he embarrass them like that? How can he be so rude? You know, how can he be so inconsiderate? Doesn't he know that they're trying? You know, all these sort of different things would come up. But over the years, what he was really responding to was, you need to put out more energy. You know, you're singing, but you're not really singing with concentration and consciousness. You're not really hearing what all the notes are. We'd all grown up in this kind of loose and thought of, you know, this is good enough. If you're feeling it, that's enough. And he was trying to train us in excellence. And he was just using that as an example. And all the singers who came through that are just immensely grateful because they themselves gradually began to see all that I was, you know, they were just being tamasic about it. I had my trial with Swamiji was learning to write because he saw that I had the potential to be a writer and he saw that I wasn't able. I didn't seem to understand how much energy it took and how much concentration to really write well. And I was always in those early years in some promotions department or another, and I had a terrible time writing. And I would, you know, finally get something together and I would bring it to him, so, you know, hopefully like this. And most of the time he threw it away. Every once in a while he would actually accept something and be very nice about it, you know. Oh, this is excellent, he would say. I mean, some things were good. But a great deal of the time he would throw it away. Sometimes he would throw it away without reading it because he could tell by touching it that the magnetism wasn't right. I actually stopped writing for almost a decade until I came down here. I just quit. I couldn't. I wanted to, but I just couldn't. I worked really, really. This was one of the wonderful Ananda history stories. Even now, maybe it's finally been made up. We had this little brochure. It was called What is Ananda? And it was this little black and white brochure with a picture of what is now Hansa Temple with these goats, little goats. If you've ever seen really old historical documents, you've seen it. And I wrote it, and it was one of the things that got through. And it was a nice little thing, you know, and it just was very factual and a little whimsical. It had some nice little touches in it. When I look at it now, it was a decent piece. And it lasted for quite a few years. Oh, well, this is actually a slightly different story that I'm telling, isn't it? But anyway, here's what happened. And then we needed to update it, essentially, because the community had changed. So I worked on it, and I wrote essentially the same piece, but I just wrote it again to be more up to date, and I passed it around. Everybody loved it. I brought it to Swami. He held it in his hand. Then he went back into his office, and in a couple of hours, he wrote something completely different. And he wrote something that was like, well, at the time, we couldn't relate to it at all. Now I find it in my files, and I think, this is a beautiful brochure. What were we thinking? But he starts by telling all the miraculous things that happened in the founding of Ananda. I start by telling what year we were founded and how many acres we have and how many people there live there. And he talked about the miracles and the effect of the masters and this and this. And he said, I think this is what's needed now. And the whole community just looked at it. Nobody could relate to it. We just didn't know how to stand behind that much energy. You know, we were just coming up from the bottom, and we just wanted to talk about the little houses we'd built in the organic gardens. And he was coming down from the top, and he wanted to talk about this divine manifestation of the guru's work, which is the Ananda. We just couldn't get there. We just couldn't go anywhere near it. So people were unwilling to put energy into his brochure, and he was absolutely unwilling to print mine. So for maybe 10 years, there was nothing. We just didn't have one. And every so often, some new person would come and ask, why don't we have a brochure about Ananda? And there was this sort of standoff of energies. And it had to go until that whole thing had just died away and people had forgotten and a whole new team was in before they could write about Ananda again. But in that case, sort of, I asked him, you know, like, what's going on here? I liked his brochure. I would have produced it, but I would have produced it out of discipleship. Not because I understood it. What was so odd to me is that when I read it recently, which was in the last few years, I couldn't understand why we had resisted it. You see, consciousness changed so much. His consciousness was so far ahead of ours, and ours was so tamasic by comparison, that we could only think in very limited terms. Now it just seems like, it doesn't even seem radical. It's like, what was wrong with us? Why couldn't we see it? But when I asked him, essentially, you know, he said, he was nice enough to me, you did a very nice job with what you set out to do. He said, but it's simply not what's needed now. And then it's the same question I always ask him, well, why didn't that other inspiration occur to me? And he was always answered, well, you didn't put out enough energy, you know, or you didn't put out, he doesn't say this, but clean enough energy, which is to say unblocked energy, energy that's not limited by my tamasic inclination to go along with what I've always done before. And he was very nice to me. And I feel like those singers, you know, his unrelenting determination to teach me what really good writing was has paid off in the end. I mean, I feel like in the book that I wrote well. I wrote as well as I can well write. He was very happy with it. I was very happy with it. I never would have reached that if he hadn't constantly, you know, been utterly honest with me is all that he was being. This is not the best that you can do. You can do better than this. He wouldn't have pushed me like that if he didn't know it was in me, because you can't push someone. And this is last Sunday in the elsewhere in the Gita that talks about three kinds of ignorance. The ignorance which is the smoke, which just drifts in front of the fire and obscures the light. And the smoke you can blow on and then the light is exposed. There's the ignorance that is like rust on a mirror, which keeps the light from reflecting properly. And you can get rid of the rust, but you have to work on it a little harder. And then there is the darkness that is like the embryo in the womb. And there's absolutely nothing you can do but wait until that embryo has grown, until it's time to extricate itself. And the Gita is talking about sattvic karma, so to speak, is karma that where there's just a little bit of delusion in place. And then you can just sort of puff and it goes away. You know, just a little misunderstanding, a little not quite complete freedom. Even a master has to have a little sattvic karma obscuring his consciousness sufficiently so that he can be in a human body. But just a little puff and it's gone. That's why they say about a master, at any point, you know, he can be free. He lives willingly in this world, but at any point he can be free. Just pull on the smoke, and then he loses complete contact with this world, if he chooses to. And the rust on the mirror is like rajasic delusion. It takes a lot more work. You know, too much of a, I can't think exactly what you would think of as an example, but, you know, too much, you're doing good works, too much attachment, for example, to good works. You know, too much thinking of oneself as the doer, for example, even though you're doing good works, too much of identification with what you're doing. You have to work a little harder to wipe that rajasic karma off. And then there's tamasic karma, which is like the baby in the womb, and you just have to wait. And sometimes with ourselves, I mean, Swamiji, my inability to write was somewhere between the baby in the womb and the rust on the mirror. Part of it is we all just had to wait until a whole lot of other issues in my life resolved so that I would be able to do it. And I also had to work on it, to work on washing the rust off the mirror. I couldn't just wait. It also required work. But it was a big karma, and it took a long time before I was able to bring that book into manifestation. Now, if we settle for less, and if we allow low-energy, sloppy work to be done when the only reason we're not doing it is because we're not applying enough energy, you can see we just bind ourselves to delusion. And so that's why, coming back to this, that Krishna describes himself as the apex of achievement in every area. Because that's when the obscuring, and this is what he says right here, when the obscuring... not so much in the sense that the highest wave is more his manifestation than the lowest, but in the sense rather that when tamas and restless rajas least obscure a divine quality, the result is like the thinning of the cloud cover which veils the moon, and the moon is revealed. So within our own natures, the divine is always present equally, but it's obscured by the tamasic and the restless rajasic energy. Restless rajasic is a little bit redundant, but he means that because there's also sattvic rajas, where you're acting, but you're acting with the calm light of spirit. So as long as those qualities are in us, that's what keeps the divinity from showing. Showing to others, being obvious to ourselves. When you see someone like Swamiji, and most of you, you know, have had this experience, if you haven't actually experienced it, I'll say that many of us have. You know, there's just something about being in his company that it's not even, although he does sometimes look really radiant, but there's this unblocked flow of energy from him. That's because he's removed from his consciousness the obscuring qualities of these gunas. And in this world, how else are we going to work for those things except by the constant application of willpower that is generally measured in excellence? And why is it that we aren't excellent in our achievements? Usually because of tamasic energy or restless rajas, which confuses us, you see? Now, let's take a break. Are there any questions about anything that we have been talking about up until now? Questions, comments, thoughts? All right. I'm assuming that's because you have perfect understanding. Not because you've been a little tamasic while I've been talking. let's see what else I... Certainly.
It's more a question out of ignorance, but what is the spelling of the third form of energy, the tamasic, rajasic, and the third form? Sattvic.
So it's not... In the very first verse of this chapter, there's all these different ways in which Krishna explains to Arjuna why Arjuna is the one who gets to hear all of this. And this one he says, I will say more to you who have listened with joy. I thought that was very interesting. Elsewhere he says, you who have overcome the carping spirit, which is another favorite quote. And now here he says, you have listened with joy and not merely listened with attention or interest or receptivity, but he adds that word in, which is just in the light, since we've been talking one theme about tamasic and rajasic and sattvic energy. The Swami traveled around the country in 1977 and 78. 1978. He went twice around the country. He went to 30 cities twice, once in the spring and once in the fall. And the subject he talked about was called the practice of joy. And he gave that lecture over and over. He gave a completely different lecture every single city, every single time, even though the topic was the same, because it was always a different group and it was a different moment in time. But he was really trying to help people to understand that whereas we tend to think that if I just can get all the things that make me unhappy out of my life, then I'll feel a lot better, he was emphasizing the fact that joy is a conscious and deliberate decision that we apply to the problems of our lives, and that's how we get the problems of our lives to go away. And it's a wonderful topic and a wonderful subject, and he spoke creatively on it 60 times. And it was still, I wasn't on the tour with him, but those who were on the tour with him said every single time he talked about it, you just learn something new about how to activate it. Now it's because, I mean, one of the realities of why we're even though we're surrounded with this divine reality, and even though the divine reality is our own nature, we don't experience it, is because our own vibration is not compatible with that divine vibration. And I was reminded during the break that I really didn't finish the thought of when you have all this weight having gone in the wrong direction, and then you suddenly... you begin to get what the right consciousness is and what a disbalance you're working against. But you see, what really solves it is all the while you're going with ego-identified, limiting consciousness, you're actually pulling very hard against the true current of life. It's true, there is a downward pulling current of Maya that you can also ride. But even underneath the Maya, the true direction of life is towards self-awareness, passage through dim corridors of waking consciousness, we say in the Festival of Light, to emerge at last into infinite joy, into perfect bliss, into perfect light, dawn, the dawn of self-awareness, which leads to this joy. Because underneath everything, the truth of this creation is bliss. So once we begin to take those steps and to direct our consciousness toward those actions which will cooperate with that nature, it's not an even trade anymore. Every time, it's really like something rolling downhill. If you're running downhill, you take a little step, but there's all this momentum. I mean, we call that the grace of God, which is really the best word for it, or the power of the Guru interceding for us. So we, every time we put a little energy in the right direction, we get much more force from it, because now we're cooperating with our own nature. We're going with the flow, so to speak. Even if the flow of our own nature is opposite than that from habit, we're into the divine flow. So the balance is different. As Master put it really simply, he said the law of karma works differently for devotees. Or the grace of God intercedes, or the grace of the Guru. The Guru has the capacity, literally, to infuse us with energy or to intercede between the inevitable results of our own karma and our own consciousness. One of the reasons that A great soul's body often suffers a great deal, seemingly, or absorbs illnesses or sicknesses or weaknesses of all kinds, is because the guru is literally the magnetic force of our karma. He's drawing that out of us and drawing that into himself. The force of the energy has to be expressed somewhere, but he can intervene before it comes to us. This is the power of a master to heal by secret yogic techniques. You know, and once one begins even a little bit to sense that relationship, and it's something that you can hear everybody talk about, but when you finally feel it, when something happens, and it's not like, oh, I got a new apartment and I was so happy, I got a parking place, but when you begin to sense within yourself that in profound and unmistakable ways, your consciousness has become different, and the difference that you experience, one can feel, has nothing to do with the effort. It's not commensurate with the effort that you've put out. You've been freed by the grace of God. That's the only way I can describe it. And you just feel it. You've been trying and trying and trying, and then all of a sudden, something happens, which is God's grace descends, and you just know. And you become like all the other saints and sages who talk about that everything is the grace of God. And then people will argue with, well, you put out a lot of energy yourself. You were really working on this. Yes, but at a certain point, you just know that all this weight of karma was still greater than anything you put out to correct it. But then the grace of God came and sucked all that karma out of you. And then there you are, and you're free. You're freer, at least. And this is where Swamiji says this in this book, that when he talks about how God works through instruments, and the instrument of his grace is the guru. And this is the divine law, that you have to have a guru to become freed. Yes?
There's a dream that someone had, I forget who it was, but... Okay, it's green. Thank you. Okay, here we are. Anyway, A dream that someone told a number of us had to do with was a devotee that dreamt about his karma being represented by a huge pile of junk and slag and formless stuff that was just in the way. And from his point of view, he was working real hard at it with his little shovels and most of his energy. He was getting little, tiny, little bits of it away. But in the dream, he had the ability to look at it from a different perspective, and around the other side of the pile is Yogananda with a big steam shovel. You know, and he's working all the time, 24 hours a day. He's taking huge chunks out of this thing. Uh-huh. And that sort of reminds me of what you were saying there. That's what's happening behind the scenes.
That's a beautiful image.
Yeah.
The chocolate Easter bunny theory is what I was talking about. You know how you get a chocolate Easter bunny, and the first one you get as a child, you think it's going to be solid chocolate, and you pierce it, and you discover that it's just a very thin veneer, even though it has this look of being just really solid. My own theory of personal development, because of the guru's inner grace, and I want to talk about Kriya before I stop, is that we look the same. We're all molded in this certain image, and we just think that we're just the same as we've always been, but the grace of God is hollowing us out from the inside. And at a certain point, that facade cracks, and you realize that all this inner change has been going on, but it didn't really show. And then suddenly, it all shows, and you realize that there was just this thin veneer of chocolate or of karma or whatever it was that gave you this form, and the form under it is completely different. It's not that we're empty inside, but that's the chocolate Easter bunny theory of personal development. Which is to say, you might not think that anything is happening, but a great deal is happening. And then, of course, you have to add the practice of Kriya into it. And it's very, very, very important to understand what's happening when we do Kriya. The masters have to work through instruments. There has to be a way in which this takes place. There's the literal mechanics of Kriya, which is that we're running energy up and down the spine and consciously through the chakras, and we're literally creating magnetism at the higher chakras, which is pulling that accumulated karma, which is nothing but a magnetic field. This is the thing that's so fascinating about it. None of it is physical. We tend to think of it, that dream was very physical with the slag heap and the shovel, which is a good image. But the truth of it is we carry this karma from bazillions of incarnations, but it doesn't fill a big box. It's just intense whirling vortices of energy, a chakra, a wheel, which is filled with vrittis. And vrittis are these little whirling points of energy where we had some reality, some thought, desire, whatever it might be, that we've identified with, and then all this whirling energy around it, but it just becomes magnetic relationships of energy, and that's all that we're working with. And when we draw very powerful energy up to the spiritual eye by the conscious use of our will, by overcoming the tamasic inclination to just sit and be what we were, by using sattvic energy, a sattvic rajasic energy, a very focused, will-oriented energy to simply lift our consciousness from lower dimensions to higher ones. And of course, when you're practicing Kriya, or any meditation, but almost all of you are Kriya bonds, when you're practicing Kriya, the tamasic inclination is to let your mind drift, to not put a lot of energy into it, to not do the practice exactly as it was taught to you, to forget about the guru while you're doing it, all these tamasic inclinations that you have to concentrate, conscious willpower, but in a very sattvic way, to move that energy. And that, of course, is a quality of energy tipping the balance. And also, when we get on that wavelength, especially when we do the Kriya in conscious relationship to the fact that we're doing this because of our discipleship to Yogananda, we're doing this as an act of devoted discipleship, we're doing this consciously as an act of devotion, then it's a perfect vehicle in which Master's consciousness can come into us. It's a perfect demonstration of our receptivity, because the Master can do anything, but he won't do anything unless we invite his intrusion, his involvement in it. Invite him, and it's no intrusion at that point. You see what I mean? And Kriya is one of the, prayer, devotion, all these practices are valid, but Kriya is one of the, the airplane route to God, as Yogananda described it, and that's one of the reasons why. Because it works directly with those vrittis. It works directly to dissolve those vrittis. It also works directly to cooperate with the divine grace. Because if God wants to help us and we're just all scattered and unfocused, it's not possible for that unity of consciousness to take place that'll change us. And that's why so much emphasis is put in Autobiography of a Yogi and, on this whole path, that first you have to become a disciple and then you can have Kriya. And we won't give people Kriya if they're not disciples, because there is no such thing as Kriya without discipleship. If you could just do Kriyas with your own ego and dissolve your vrittis, it can't be done. What you're really doing is you're overcoming your own tamasic attachment to those vrittis sufficiently so that your consciousness can merge with the guru and the guru can dissolve them for you on a level that we just can't do with our own egoic will. It's really an extraordinary path, and we're talking about self-realization as taught by Paramahansa Yogananda, but we're also talking about self-realization as taught by every great master who ever lived, because this is the spiritual path. And it's pretty easy to listen with joy, because when you really see all that's promised to us by these words of Krishna, which are the words of all true masters and specifically even of our own practice, it's like, how could you listen with anything else? There's this point at which, even though you have normal human emotions, even if you're a Jivan Mukta, you're never inwardly touched. Because behind everything that happens in this world is this deep realization of the path that we're on, the protection that we're under, the process that we're undergoing, and how really unimportant everything is compared to that. Master said it so simply, it doesn't make any difference what happens to you in your life. The only thing that matters is what you become through it. And so if when these very challenging situations come to us, as they come to all of us, it causes us to just go deeper into the spine and deeper into our discipleship and deeper into our practice of Kriya and deeper into this determined commitment to overcome the tamasic energy, to use the power of the will to put out energy in the right way and to become inwardly free, then you think, what difference does it make what the exercise is? If I use it properly, then everything leads to bliss. So what do I care? And that's how you see the attitudes of the saints, and you see Swamiji say, difficulties in my life? What difficulties? And we say from the outset, oh, but this, but that. And he says, it's just been my relationship with my guru. That's all I've been doing. Life gets so incredibly simple. Becomes your relationship with your guru, and that's all you're ever doing. That's why there's this scriptural statement. I was meditating on it recently. If guru is pleased, it doesn't matter about anything else. And if the world is pleased and guru is displeased, you know, when I just mentioned that little bit of Swami throwing away my writing. I mean, it didn't make any difference to me if everybody else thought it was good. He knew me better than anyone else. If he didn't think it was good, it wasn't good. That's all. Because he was working with who I really was. Everybody else was just working with their potentials. I mean, their opinions, their perceptions. But he was working with who I could really become. And all the time, that's what God is doing. If you find yourself being challenged, it's because God knows you have more potential than you're showing. And he's determined that you will.
As you were saying, I read that if everyone else is displeased with you, if the guru's pleased, that's all that matters. But if everyone else, if God is displeased with you, only the guru can save you. But if the guru is displeased
with
you,
even God can't save you.
Which is a great point.
Those are very poetic ways of putting it, but you read those over and over, and then one day it occurs to you, on a very deep personal level, exactly why that's true. It's because the guru has your best interest at heart and he knows how to get you there. And other people, even if they're very good people, they're just guessing. So you have to be respectful. This isn't a formula for being rude. But deep in your heart, it doesn't make any difference. So, that will be it for tonight. Thank you all. Bless you.